All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Inside In Tennis Podcast, all part of the Believe Network. A lot of great content on this show and all the podcasts on Believe. Mitch Michaels here, reminding you again, find the show on Spotify, Apple, wherever you get your podcasts as we keep gearing up in this wild and crazy tennis season. Friend of the show returning right now. It's been a while since I've chatted with him. Excited to get into all the content he's covering, all the events and storylines in the sport. Matt Futterman, New York Times, now working at The Athletic, spearheading their tremendous coverage. Matt, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be back.
Yeah, it's been a minute, and I know now better than to ask you what you're cooking up. We'll just wait and see, you know, what the next story is. But no, it's been an interesting time. I'm delighted to talk with you here. And I know we're chatting, you know, a couple weeks after you returned from Australia, another major that you covered on site. You know, what was the experience like being down there? I know you're used to it, but just for the listeners and viewers too, who might not understand how it works, being there as a journalist, covering the event, getting to chat with interesting people, what was that experience like being on site?
Yeah, it's always an adventure getting to Australia. You're always reminded of just how uncommonly large the Pacific Ocean is. And just how far away it is. I would say the adventure, you know, really started, almost as soon as I left LA. I actually traveled there on the night the fires broke out. And I took off out of LAX on that Tuesday night. And I had been, I'd heard about the fires all afternoon. And then, was in the airport for a few hours on the layover, and it was a very sort of strange and eerie time in the airport because there was this sort of craziness unfolding not far away. And then we took off, and the flight pattern out of LAX, we went south and then veered north, and we really went almost right over offshore of Pacific Palisades, and you could just see the city on fire. And I took some pictures of it from the airplane. You could actually smell it for a few seconds there. So, I remember landing in LA and landing in Australia, and my first thoughts were just, back in LA, and just sort of couldn't believe, what I had seen and what was going on. So I sort of landed, and I would say that, the fires, we were so far away, but it really covered, or colored, I should say, like a lot of thought time, being down there so far away. But in the whole issue with Pam Shriver, and then I have a daughter who lives in LA. So it was kind of like living it through there, and sort of two things happening at once. That was sort of what made it unique to this year. And in terms of being down there, it was, it was pretty great weather for the most part. Only one like crazy hot day. Melbourne is an amazing, thriving city. I would say what makes it unique to the other Grand Slams is Melbourne is just small enough, so it really feels like the tournament kind of takes over the whole city.
Yeah.
It's kind of everywhere. I mean, when the US Open is in New York, the US Open is one of 30 different things happening in New York, and similar to, I think, Wimbledon and London, and Paris is Paris. So that's sort of like what I'm always struck by, is sort of like how much this event really infiltrates the city.
Yeah. And you wrote in one of your pieces talking about how it's like Silicon Valley has kind of made this, has had that kind of effect on Australia, how this tournament's become the fun, exciting party type atmosphere. Following the sport, not quite as long as you, but following the sport, I've noticed that this has been not a sudden trend, but it's gradually gotten there. Have you seen that too, to where each year it seems like it's slowly getting more and more exciting, the vibes continually shift up, and it just seems like it gets rowdier each time they have it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm completely biased, but, I really feel like, so Australia and the US Open are kind of like tennis how it ought to be.
Okay.
And, I think it is special that Wimbledon sort of takes you back to another time period, and it does that. And it's fine that we have that for 2 weeks a year, but you know, there's a certain lack of pretension in the Australian Open and the US Open. And I think a lot of it starts with both the you know, I'd say what sticks out to me is, you know, initially the music and the sounds. You know, it's just the sounds of a big event at the US Open. You know, you immediately hear this. So if you get there and there's just this soundtrack running, and whether it's Madonna or Bruce Springsteen or whatever, there's just noise. And the same thing in Australia. Australia does this amazing thing where it has these like singer-songwriters playing on the lawn throughout the tournament. And so you have a lot of people who are just sort of hanging out all afternoon. They're taking in some tennis, but they're taking in a lot of music and drinking sun. And, you know, it's been sort of a real sort of move by the organizers to, you know, it's an event, it's a happening, and there happens to be tennis going along with it. And, you know, that's fine. Most people go into this tournament, they don't actually know who a lot of the players are. But they're looking to have a great time. And I always think tennis messes up when it tries to treat itself too preciously.
And it takes the fun out. Yeah, I think that's where a misstep is a lot of the times. And yeah, that was the first thing, the very first time I actually went to Indian Wells, like 9 or 10 years ago, I was struck by just the vibe of how much fun it was, where people are just enjoying, like you said, the live music and the experience of the whole matter. Final thought on Australia before we move on, Matt. Was there anybody, I know you get to talk to a lot of players and coaches and personalities, anyone you talked to that you found particularly insightful, or maybe that you learned something from, maybe someone that you weren't even expecting it from?
Well, I guess topping the list would have to be Madison Keys. I mean, she's, I'd spoken about this with some other people, how, you know, Madison had been kind of an enigma the last few years. I found her to be, I think a lot of people in the press sort of found her to be a bit cold and distant. And she didn't seem all that happy. And, you know, it turns out she wasn't all that happy. I mean, she was sort of, you know, struggling to get to a headspace where, as she put it, she could be happy separate from whatever was happening on the tennis court, you know, sort of separating her results from her satisfaction as a human being. And that's a really, really hard process if you're someone who has grown up the way she did, which is from the time, you know, you're 8, 10, 12 years old, people are telling you you're going to be Serena Williams. And I hadn't ever had the opportunity to sort of sit with her one-on-one, and I'd asked a number of times and it just sort of had never worked out. But then all of a sudden I sort of got that opportunity, and I was a little nervous actually at first.
Was it before the final? It was before she went, I'm
yeah,
assuming.
It was after her fourth round. It was after she beat Rybakina, before the fiddling. I think it was before the Svitolina match, or excuse me. It was after the Svitolina match, because I remember she just had one day turnaround. So I especially didn't expect it, because I had put in for it, but I thought, oh, she's only got 24 hours. And she did, and just sort of, she came in and she was just sort of like bright and bubbly, and, you know, she came off winning, but she was so sort of open and out there and revealing, and very quickly sort of like just drew me into this journey she's been on with Bjorn, her husband Bjorn Fantangelo, and what that had been like over the last basically year and a half. And so I would say that's, you know, that's going to stay with me. Just, it's got to stay with me forever, given that, and given how I had spoken with Bjorn at the beginning of all this at Wimbledon in 2023. And I noticed she was like suddenly playing really well, and she had won Eastbourne, and it came out of one of her matches, and I knew him a little bit, and I saw him, and I was like, so are you coaching her? And he's like, but not really. And I was like, well, it kind of looks like you're coaching her. You're sitting in the box. He's like, yeah, but it's just temporary. I'm not doing this. I got stuff to do. And I kind of like smiled, and I was kind of like, well, good luck with that, Bjorn. Like, I
That's
don't
for
know.
life, yeah.
I don't think you're, I don't think this is a job that you're going to be allowed to quit. And, you know, I will take deep satisfaction always having been right
That's
about
fair.
that, the way things worked out. So, you know, that's that journey that you've been on, and just sort of the way it all worked out, and you know, just how open she was about it. And having spoke, I think I spoke with Bjorn after the Rybakina match in the fourth round, and then was able to follow up with Madison a couple of days later. And so by the time she was playing that semifinal, I felt like I really had a good understanding of where she was and where they were and what was going on inside her head as those matches were unfolding.
Still just one of the more remarkable runs, let alone first major run, to beat all the players she did. Iga, then Sabalenka to finish it off. It was just, it was stunning. It was very, very impressive. Good to hear the insight here.
I think any
Matt,
one, I
yeah.
mean, like any one of those wins of those last, you know, I guess maybe you might put Svitolina in a
Yeah.
different category. But any like one of those last three wins on the way to a title,
Yeah.
you know,
I mean,
would
the
be
two
pretty
worst were
cool.
Svitolina and Collins. So, like, those two plus those three, those are the five
Right.
players she beat.
Right. And Collins, who like for a time was the best player in the
Yeah.
world last year. Svitolina, who has had her moments in the last couple of years of being just absolutely lights out.
Yeah.
And, you know, and she just like one right after the other. And also
Yes.
to do it in the last two matches, the way she do it, and really in all those matches, like really just like playing her best tennis down the
Yeah.
line. You know, like in the final stretch, like the only thing I could think about it was, you know, I'm a runner, and so you think about like these races where somebody just like outkicks somebody in the final 30 meters and like or 20 meters, or sometimes it's 5 meters, and like that's what it reminded me of, especially the Iga match where,
Yeah.
you know. I think she never led until 9-8 in the tiebreaker, right? I mean, it was something like
Yeah,
it
it
was just
was save those match points,
save
save those
right.
match points, and then ended up making just, yeah, the tiebreak. She was down, didn't have match points down, but was down the entire time, just chipping away and
Right,
finding a
chipping away and then just sort of like serve, but even it, you know, it was just sort of remarkable. I mean, you
way.
just like it had been almost like 2 hours since she had like anything approaching
Crazy.
a lead from like early in the first set, I think. And so, and then all of a sudden it was just, you know, went from 8-7 in the tiebreaker, or I guess 7-8 or whatever, I forget who was serving. And then all of a sudden just rattled off those last 3 points. And that's what it reminded me of. It was like neck and neck with 5 meters to go, and somebody just leans
Yeah.
eight, and there it is.
Crazy for her. Looks like she's going to be entering the top five as well with Paulini going out early. So it's going to be just a great time to see what Madison Keys' next step's going to be here with Matt Futterman on the Inside in Tennis podcast. Have to bring up, the story that you wrote with Charlie Ecclesher and The Athletic, the New York Times piece about Elena Rybakina, the updated version of what's going on. We've been following this story along, your tremendous reporting. Stefan Vukov, her former coach that there is some involvement with, still is suspended. His provisional suspension was upheld. It is a year. There's a lot of terms on if he can be restated. There's a lot to unpack there. Rybakina is not commenting, refuses to say anything to speak out against any of the treatment that was found to have been held by the WTA. Before getting into, and even if we don't want to get into all that, but before touching on it, Matt, from a journalist, from a reporter, because the question I wanted to ask you was, and a lot of ourselves, myself, media, Jason, had heard rumblings, had heard rumors. But as a reporter, how do you pursue and how did you pursue a story like this to find and to discover what the facts were and to do it in a very ethical case? Because this was very serious subject matter to uncover.
Right. I mean, I think in any story, the first thing you try to like figure out is like who has the information that you're seeking, and you know, so who's participating in this investigation? Who's in the inner circle? Who's you know, who are important to people to talk to. It's really important in this story to try and figure out, like, what exactly went on, what got reported, what got investigated, and, you know, and what can be backed up. And so, you know, that's a pretty, it's a pretty small universe of people, none of whom really want to talk about it. Or some, actually, that's not true. Some really, really want to talk about it because, you know, they're desperately trying to protect the safety of Elena. And it's a complicated story because of her position on this. I mean, I've covered, you know, stories of abuse before, but I think in every case before, the, you know, person who was being abused was certainly against the person who was being accused of abusing her. This is a case where Elena is, you know, Stefana Vukov's biggest defender, and yet, or at least she is now, and yet there have been times when she has complained about him to people who are close with her. And so, look, it's a matter of trying to get access to the people who have the information, and people who are involved in the investigation and people who have knowledge of it. And, you know, once the WTA made its determination, and issued a letter, you know, and issued a finding, you know, there's apparently a significant report that they've also done. And, you know, what I've been able to review is the sort of summary of that report, which spells out a number of things that they've confirmed, whether it was sort of refusing to leave the hotel in New York, after he was dismissed as her coach, or the sort of name calling and berating her at the Miami Open in 2023, and then repeated incidents like that that have been complained about. You know, it was sort of getting, understanding what the tour, which has invested a significant number of resources in this investigation, what they had been able to find out. So, like I said, it's a matter of getting access to the people and to the information, and, you know, making a lot of phone calls and checking a lot of things. And, you know, it helps to have been covering the sport for a while and to have some contacts.
In your opinion, how you're reviewing, like, the reaction to the story, are you finding that people believe that the WTA has done all that they could, that it is a really tricky situation, that they're on top of it? Or is there a perception that more could have been done? Because this is, as you mentioned, kind of unprecedented in a lot of ways.
So, you know, I guess you could always say that more could have been done. I do sort of think of, I think they were in a tough spot in the sense that they had a lot of they had a lot of complaints about him, but they didn't have any evidence of, you know, physical abuse or sexual abuse, and they also had, you know, a quote unquote victim who was backing him. So I think what they really needed was, you know, some sort of tripwire that he would go over, in the case of, you know, Jelena Dokic some 20 years ago. I think it was her father, you know, what, throwing food or doing something like that at a worker. And, you know, they had been hearing complaints and getting evidence about him. But they, you know, ultimately, you know, then this incident happened and I think there were witnesses and things like that. You know, what happened in New York after she dismissed him and he continued to, you know, what, if you read the description, read and listen to the description of this, you know, it sounds, you know, essentially like stalking. you know,
and it does,
you know, kind of refusing to leave. And then you read about, you know, hundreds of phone calls and text messages, and you can imagine being on the receiving end of all that. And then what that might feel like, that feels pretty bad. And that's also, you know, that's also stuff that's trackable. And
yeah.
So once you get that, once you have that information and right. you possess it, then I think it becomes finally the point where they can start to take some action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm sympathetic to the WTA in a lot of ways. First of all, very sympathetic. We all wish Rybakina is okay, doing well, supporting her in any way through all this. But for the WTA and their findings, which I think has been fair given the tough circumstances, Matt, there is a question of, is 1 year going to be, like, is there any scenario where he's back in a year? I know there's provisions, but is that a realistic outcome that 1 year is done and he's back?
I mean, look, unless there's some change in the status quo, she seems very intent on continuing to use him, you know, as her coach. I mean, I think that she's been pretty upfront about the fact that he's still basically coaching her, but just not during matches. Right. And that he's working with Devi Sangonetti, and that they're in constant contact.
The Goran piece of this was crazy too, because she had one of the premier coaches in all of tennis on board. And as you wrote about, covered, and highlighted, you know, a lot of people several times mentioned it, he was caught completely off guard by this whole scenario of bringing him back.
Yeah. And I think that's important. I think that, you know, you can't really imagine doing that to just about any coach, and to doing it to Goran in particular, who's been sort of, you know, probably had a pretty good choice on who he would coach after you know, he broke things off with Djokovic. So the idea that, I don't know, he would be sort of, he would be treated in that way is, you know, pretty surprising, especially to him. It was certainly surprising to all of us. But, you know, it's a strange situation. And yeah, is 1 year enough? You know, I don't know. I think it will, you know, I do think one of the outcomes of this becoming public is that, you know, I think other players will certainly think twice about hiring him in the future.
We'll see what happens as this story develops. Again, your work along with Charlie Echols shared great covering this. We wish her the best. She's been able to compartmentalize, I think, is one way to look at it too, given how she wins again. She's been doing well, lost that match to Keys in Australia, but is into the Dubai semis, beating Sophia Kennan. So that Dubai women's event, by the way, as we segue onto the tennis, Matt's been interesting. You had a lot of upsets, and there may be reasons for that. Maybe just players rising up. One of the players who lost was Iga Swiatek to Mira Andreeva. And on the Andreeva side, Matt, we've discussed her quite a bit in her young career, still 17 years of age. She was having her way with Iga in a way very few players are able to. It was a very impressive professional performance. What I love watching about Andreeva, Matt, is every time she's on the court in this young, early stage, she seems to be adapting, getting smarter, ultimately getting better.
Right. She's a little bit, you know, falls into that AI category where she just sort of like, I mean, you just can't believe she's 17, you know, and she's just accumulating information. And, I think it's so interesting in this era when players like Andreeva, Paolini, you know, players who don't look like Aryna Sabalenka are finding ways to win. I mean, Andreeva's got a lot of pop in her shots. And she hits some beautiful, incredibly solid balls, but, you know, she's not, she's not breaking radar. You know, I don't think she's breaking radar guns, and yet, you know, it's just one of the great things about the sport is that, you know, champions really can come in a lot of different shapes and sizes, especially in the women's game.
Yeah, she was down a break in the second set, broke back, and then rolled off the last four games to win. Really getting smarter, got an early head start, providing her to take her lumps earlier. Now, yeah, still a teenager, a lot of winning coming up for her. On the Iga Swiatek front, Matt, we've heard players discuss this before. The idea, and Iga said after the match, that she thinks the season is too long, that she didn't feel like she had it, and that back-to-back 1,000-level events is not ideal and not great for the tour. And I have a pretty straight-up response to this. I think it's an adequate point. I think it makes total sense. I don't like doing it immediately after a loss, especially when Andreeva gets her first, or one of her biggest wins of her career. So on the topic, though, of the schedule and the season being too long, yes, it's a fair point, but how does this ever change would be my countered question to that.
I think it's really hard to, change it given the structure of the sport right now. There's just too many people who are in charge, who are economically incentivized to maintain the status quo. And, you know, those would be at the top of that list is the tournament owners. And, you know, if the only way to shorten the season is to get rid of some tournaments or diminish the importance of some of them. And that's a really hard thing to do because these people have invested a lot in the tournaments. That's one issue. You know, the other issue is you could decrease the number of mandatory tournaments. You could decrease the amount of tournaments you have to play that go towards your ranking. That's something that could be done. You know, I haven't discussed that in depth with Steve Simon. I did put it to Andrea Gaudenzi, and he just sort of smacked it down and, you know, basically said, you know, hey, look, what these players have to play, you know, it's not that much. And I sort of, and, you know, easy for you to say, you know, you played in the 90s when this was a different sport. B, you know, you're attending tournaments wearing a suit and hanging out in corporate suites.
Air conditioning.
Yeah, and air conditioning. And you're not, you know, killing yourself in the most physical version of the sport that it's ever been. So, I think I think maybe those tweaks should happen, but mostly if the change is going to happen, it's going to be one of those things where the players are going to have to force change somehow.
Yeah. And be unified too, which is the other part of this. Players don't necessarily, it's hard to get anybody to agree on a lot of things, especially something this big. I will also say too, it's tough, and you can speak to this as well. When you're one of these top players that's had slam success, it might be a little hard to find motivation now. Coco Gauff losing early. Sabalenka has lost a couple since Australia. There's a counter to that too, right? There's an opportunity for players to get those ranking points, to get that breakthrough. Clara Tauson does a great job. You've seen, you know, Sonia Kristeva lost today, but she played like 6 hours 2 days ago. So there's opportunity there. And I think especially if you're a younger player, this can be your moment to make your move. We saw Paulini do it last year. It set up her whole season.
Yeah, this is an interesting time of the season. This sort of this Middle East swing, and on the men's side, they have some tournaments in the Middle East. You got the great South American swing, which, you know, I think there's pretty widespread agreement at this point that the tour just doesn't spend enough time in South America.
It's so fun. I mean,
you look at
the crowds, like we were talking about Australia, right? Like the crowds of the Golden Swing provide a glimpse into another way for how this sport maybe should be. And if we're a global game, right, we have to spend time in all the reaches of the world. And when Fonseca wins, I mean, I know he lost and there's a lot of pressure to come back after your first title and play at home, but he got a hero's welcome at home. The Argentinians are adored there. I mean, it's so special to see these players get that chance, and the fans who love and support the game get to see real life pro tennis.
Right. And I mean, and you can contrast what you see in those settings versus, I mean, the Sestea Navarro match was probably one of the best matches we're going to have all year. It was completely insane. It was the outcome was unknowable until the end. There was, you know, I love lead changes in sports. It's one of the reasons why I'd like to, why, you know, I think I've thrown out there, like, in doubles, I want to, especially men's doubles, I'd like to go only one serve. And, you know, I think, you know, why I don't dislike no ad scoring as much as other people do. You know, I don't know if you should do it in the Grand Slams, but like, I love lead changes. There's so many lead changes in the Navarro match. It's one of the great matches. And I don't know if there were 100 people in there.
I know. Like, it was tough. Yeah.
And like, and you know, the women's tennis and so much time in the Middle East, and they just don't, you know, I know that the sponsors supported and they put up the prize money and stuff, but like, it's just a shame when you see that contrasted with the life that you have in Rio and in Buenos Aires every year. And I imagine if you would, I imagine when you have the tournaments in Chile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's that photo that was circulating with Fonseca as a kid with Curtin. And I'm thinking, that's the reason. That's one of the main reasons why he gets to this point, is seeing a guy in the flesh that's done it. And now there'll be kids that are watching Fonseca along the way. So I'm with you there. And just the final note on the women. I mean, the final four of this, it's Rybakina, who's the, you know, proven champion. But Muhova back in the mix. Love her game. Love to see it. You know, Clara Tauson and Andreeva. So not the final four we'd expect, but good to see Tauson in here too. I did want to mention that her game has always been big. 3 years ago at the Australian Open, she kind of burst on the scene, had some injury issues, but back in the mix, has a very big game as well.
Sure. It's impressive. And remember, we're just coming off of Amanda Anisimova winning, winning in Doha. I don't want to say out of nowhere, but you know, her first win in a while. And so, you know, the depth of talent is just like incredibly impressive. You know, Coco losing in the first round here, you know, it's kind of a tough draw, you know? I mean, it happens. And there's not a lot of safety in a women's non-Grand Slam these days.
Yeah, I think the depth on both tours is so good. I know players, former players, and maybe fans want to go back to 16 seeds. I personally just don't think you need it. You can still have these great first-round matches with how much depth there is. And yeah, you're right. I mean, it's brutal, some of the draws. And some of these unseeded players, quotes, are very good and probably won't be unseeded for long.
You would have expected, like, one of, not necessarily Tommy, because he pulled out of Delray Beach with a little bit of an injury. But, you know, let's say you would have expected Fritz to, you know, win Dallas or Delray Beach or something. And he didn't, you know. And that's a little weird, but, like, I don't know. Can you really, you know, like, he had tough matches, and there's just no gimmies. If you're playing in, you know, essentially, you know, a home tournament in Delray Beach. So it's, and you're the, what's he, two-time defending champion there. Yeah. So it's like I said, no one is giving anything for free. Not that they ever did for the most part, but, you know, you see that more than ever now.
So a couple more things here with Matt Futterman on the Inside in Tennis podcast. I want to get your thoughts, Matt, on the men's game and some of the events we've seen, or really the event in Doha that we're starting to see this week. They'll be in Dubai next week, but some great matches. Now, there might be different players that aren't, you know, at full capacity. There's issues with some players out, but the players that are in have been investing in. And today in particular, as we record this, we saw some pretty epic matches. Yuri Lehechka beat Carlos Alcaraz 3 sets in a wild match. Lehechka up early. Alcaraz levels it. They go to the third. Alcaraz is up a break, has a chance for the double break, and Ljubicic just rattles off four straight games. So Jiří Ljubicic's level, very, very impressive. This was, I guess, another level. And I would ask you this question. Do you see the ceiling being as high as it was in this match going forward for a guy who clearly proved that he can play with the best players?
I mean, Ljubicic, I think everybody knows, is like one of the great ball strikers on tour and is capable of some really big stuff. It's just a matter of like whether he can do it consistently. I mean, there's so many players. You just go through like the Czech players immediately, like Ljubicic, Mensik, Mahac. Like, those are like three absolutely terrific players. It'll be interesting watching the U.S. play them in the Davis Cup in September. I mean, that's like just some a terrific lineup of players. But are they, like, is their average great week in and week out? Or is is their average good enough week in and week out? Like I said, I mean, Ljubicic, yes, he played great today. I guess my big takeaway from today was, and I was thinking this a little bit yesterday when I was watching the Alcaraz play Luca Nardi. It seemed like both, you know, Ljubicic and Nardi were sort of able to jump on Alcaraz's serve at moments. And, you know, you know that Carlos has been working on that and changed his motion up a little bit. And, you know, it's, everybody's always said that it's the weakest part of his game. You know, even though in Wimbledon last year, he basically hit the lines at 130 miles an hour for three sets straight. You know, like, so we know what he's capable of, but he's probably not going to do that every day. And so, you know, it's one thing that I'm particularly interested to keep an eye on is like, what is going to happen with his serve? He has this period with Sinner out where he can really like maybe make up some ground on him.
One's in play. I mean, it's the dips that he has in matches are real. And I think part of that, maybe part that's not discussed as much, Matt, is that his ceiling when he's on is just so absurdly high. It's kind of hard to maintain that. It'd be hard for anyone to maintain that level. But there is parts in matches, maybe more so than a Sinner or certainly a Djokovic match, where you feel like if you're his opponent, you got to be playing well, obviously. That if I stay in this fight, if I stay in it, I'm going to get a chance to come back in. Because, yeah, in every Alcaraz match, it seems like there's 20 minutes where you're not touching him. He's otherworldly.
Right. And there may also be 20 minutes where, you know, like he can't find the court, strangely. Mm-hmm. There was that, you know, second set against Nardi on Wednesday where it just seemed like all of a sudden it was like another being had inhabited him. and then he, you know, found it.
Yeah.
But all credit to Ljubicic. He hung in there today and he kept his concentration. And, you know, and he does that. I remember watching him play that five setter against Tommy Paul a couple of years ago at Wimbledon. And, you know, this was sort of early Ljubicic, let's say. Yeah. And, you know, he was just there, you know. Paul, you know, on paper, the better player, the higher seed, all those sorts of higher ranked player. But Ljubicic has a real mental toughness and an ability to hang in there.
That was an epic match today, as was Berrettini, Jack Draper. Draper pulling that one out. For Berrettini, it's great to see him back in the mix. He seems like he's back to normal health. He's proving what he can do. Jack Draper gets the win after losing the first set. He was at a point, I think, 0-10 on breakpoint chances, but just stuck with it. Found a way to get the break in the second, got one in the third, and just served it all the way out. He's up to, at the least, we'll see how it finishes, Matt, but up to number 14, a career high in the live ranking. Jack Draper, another young guy, a British guy with a lot of potential, quietly putting together a really solid overall game and a lot of solid mental strength as well.
So I think two really, really important players for men's tennis. I think Fonseca and Draper are just really, really important just because I think Fonseca is just a complete game changer in terms of bringing South America along and creating interest in the sport, and not just in South America, but you know, there's a pretty heady South American diaspora all over the world. We saw it in Australia with Brazilian. I mean, who knew that Australia had this massive Brazilian population? But then you think about it, Brazil has, 200 million people or something like that. Of course they're everywhere. And now you're going to really see them in big numbers. And I think Draper is really important too, because Great Britain is just such an important place for tennis. The history because of Wimbledon, and also picking up after Andy Murray. I mean, he really carried that country for a long time. And, for Draper to be able to pick up from there and to keep the interest in England at a fever pitch is just incredibly important. And especially because like, other than Draper, there's not a lot of other British men who are showing this signs. Jacob Fernley's is solid so far, but he's got a little ways to go. It wasn't long ago he was playing for TCU.
Yeah, he's very important to what the sport can be. Love his game too. The lefty
The British journalists were when he had that success last year at the U.S. Open. The British journalists were. What they couldn't quite understand, like, wow, this guy's really popular. And
with the British journalists?
The British journalists, okay. They thought he was popular in Britain.
No.
They didn't understand. I have a 19-year-old daughter and a couple other ones too around that age. And I said to them, I was like, yeah, they know exactly who he is. I was like, he's hugely popular with that Gen Z cohort. So he brings in a collection of people that I think are really important to the future of the sport.
Can't wait to see where he goes. You had other things in Doha. I just want to mention Felix advances to the semifinals, playing one set in his last two matches. So that's a nice day at the office, a couple of days for him, with Medvedev retiring with food poisoning. And then everybody's favorite tortured soul, Andrei Rublev, who survives today. One of the craziest matches I've seen, Matt. We discussed Rublev before, how he fights to stay together. He had match points against Demonauer at 5-2, 5-3, and 5-4. Gets to a tiebreak, has a few more, finally does win that match. Just on the surface, end result, huge win to beat Demonauer, the way he's been playing. But I don't think if you polled a lot of people, they thought, given how those games went, that Rublev would have pulled it off. So credit to him.
Yeah, he's a bit of an enigma, but look, he's a solid player. The talent shouldn't go anywhere. He's kind of just got to stay out of his own way. It seems like he's working on it, and I think between it moving on to the other guy you mentioned, Felix. And we saw Shapovalov having that great success in Dallas. I mean, it wasn't long ago that everybody was talking about Canada kind of taking over men's tennis. With Andreescu and Fernandez, maybe taking over women's tennis to some extent too. Maybe not taking over, but, having a major impact. And again, another sort of important market. And, if Felix and Shapovalov can get on track once more, get over the health struggles that they've had the last year and a half or so, and be the players that I think a lot of people thought they were, that sort of, I think, can make things very exciting moving forward, because they're still pretty young.
That's the point. I was going to say it if you didn't, is that Felix is still under 25. Shapovalov is right there. There's still so much tennis for them left to be played. I know it could seem like they got overshadowed by some young superstars, but they can still get better. They can still have results, as Shapovalov proved. And we'll see Felix. This is an opportunity, as we mentioned. Draper's in the mix here. Felix is in the mix. Yuri Lahechka, Rublev. Like, someone's going to win a pretty big title and carry with them some momentum. So we'll see. And then the last thing I had for you, Matt, was you mentioned we're gearing up for the Sunshine Double.
Yeah.
Indian Wells wild cards came out. You have Fonseca, Werner, Tien, and then Venus Williams back again. So
Right. Yes. Venus, 44 years old, number 924 in the world. And she's been training and wants to give it another go. I can argue both sides of it.
Yes.
You know, I think that Venus is obviously a absolutely legendary figure. It brings a lot of atmosphere to any tournament. At the same time, I mean, she hasn't played in a really long time. There's a lot of players who've been, you know, playing their tails off. And, you know, we'll see who else gets those spots, you know, gets the other wild cards there. You know, it's something that tennis does that a lot of other sports don't do. And I'm certainly empathetic. There is a part of me that wonders if it's really, you know, what is there damage that gets done to tennis by, you know, being able to just bring someone off the bench like that.
It's like, yeah, they're not going to see it's like the NFL. All right, New York Giants, you're in the playoffs. It's like, it's not going to happen in that regard.
Yeah, it feels odd.
I get it though.
Especially at a tournament of this import. But maybe that's the point. Maybe you want to do it at a tournament of this import. So it gets attention. And like I said, you know, if someone has made a judgment that, you know, Venus can be competitive after not playing for a year and at her age, which, you know, look, 44 is not old, but in tennis terms, it's getting up there. So, you know, I just really hope that for the part of me that feels like, yeah, that's not who wild card should be going to, I hope she, you know, shuts me up and wins 2-2 or something like that. Yeah. I hope she doesn't. And what I really hope is that she doesn't go out there and, you know, have a bad day.
Yeah. Tournaments can do what they want. I think there's decisions we can be critical of and debate whether or not this is competitively something that should be done. But at the end of the day, it's the tournament's right in the sport of tennis, the unique and special sport of tennis. Well, Matt Futterman, we always appreciate having you on the show. Is there anything else? And I want to ask you again, I'm not going to ask you what you're working on, but anything you'd like to promote, things you'd like to promote, or maybe just where you're headed next for tennis?
Yeah, I'm headed to Indian Wells next. So I'm headed to Indian Wells and headed to Miami. So I'm really looking forward to those events. Especially, we'll certainly be focused on. I think there's a lot of interesting things up in the air. Coco and Aryna Sabalenka is sort of like at the top of it. Iga as well. Usually she's coming in here with a pretty good head of steam. She's not. And I am particularly curious, of course, about Carlos, who I kind of think, like, there's every reason why he should win Indian Wells, like,
every year.
is he going to actually do that? And by all indications, Novak is going to play. I don't think it seems like he's given indications that he wants to do the Sunshine Double. And I think that's great. He brings so much. And, I mean, in Australia, you asked before we started this conversation with what it was like to cover Australia. And, you know, that first week when he was just making all these headlines, we were sitting around and looking at each other and thinking, like, what are we going to do when this guy isn't playing anymore? Like,
yeah.
It's just amazing. Yeah.
Can't take him for granted, but it's exciting. It's exciting. Yeah.
Everything about him is exciting. It's just like, he's a walking story, you know, no matter where he goes. And it's great. And we're all going to, you know, love him or hate him. Everyone's going to miss him when he's gone.
And he handles losses well, too, now. It's a learned thing. He's very gracious in defeat. I think that's something people can look to, which we just saw in the Berrettini match. Well, Matt Futterman, this is a blast, as always, to chat with you, learn some things. You can follow Matt at The Athletic. He was covering the New York Times tennis department and doing some exceptional things at The Athletic, covering the game and shedding light on a lot of these stories and players. So, Matt Futterman, thanks for joining the podcast. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me, Mitch.
That was Matt Futterman. This is the Inside In Tennis Podcast. We're available on all your podcast platforms. So whether you get your shows on Apple, Spotify, iHeart, or Amazon Music, you can subscribe by just searching Inside In Tennis Podcast. Leave a rating or a review and check out my YouTube channel. Mitch Michaels is the @ for all the video episodes of the show. We're back next week. More content on the Inside In Tennis Podcast, all part of the Believe Network. So for Matt Futterman, my name is Mitch Michaels. This was the Inside In Tennis Podcast. Thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you soon.